It's been a while since you put me on the shelf. I know you've been distracted by somebody else. It's been a while, but that's all right, you see. And I'll be right here waiting when you want to play again with me.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Cult of the Old. We are back out of hibernation and have a new season for you. But it's not just me, Ian McAllister, here. I'm also joined by two fellow critics and hosts of this cast, Matt Thrower and Nate Owens. How are you doing, gents?
Good. Thank you very much. How are you, Ian?
I am not bad. I'm very glad to be seeing your lovely face again and getting back into talking about older games. It's going to be a lot of fun. We've got a lot of interesting games to talk about over the course of this season. So what do we do here? If you're joining us for the first time, each episode I and my fellow hosts are going to dive into the tabletop gaming past. We're going to turn back the release schedule at least 10 years to look at games that were setting tables ablaze in the dim and distant past of at least a whole decade ago. In our previous season, we covered games that were available either in physical form or in illegal digital means. This season, we're throwing that rule out so we can cover a wider range of games that we nonetheless think are important to talk about. Where we can, we will point you towards ways to play those games we are covering, and they may still be available to play in your local game stores. Now, this season of Cult of the Old, we've decided to go back to the start of the modern era. There was a time when what we consider hobby board games were played in small shops and clubs across the land, never hoping to be seen in the more mainstream outlets that we might consider on our high streets. Arriving onto the scene in the mid-90s, our first game of this season was a breath of fresh air into a hobby that had grown somewhat stale. As people across the world traded wood for sheep and made ill-advised double entendres, this game appeared in homes in every country and made its way into the mainstream. It is now available in over 40 languages and has sold over 40 million copies. One of the reasons we are covering this game is that its designer Klaus Teuber passed recently, and so this is our tribute to him and the game he created, Settlers of Catan. So, who wants to take on Settlers of Catan for a one-minute breakdown?
I'll do it, Ian. I'm here, by the way. I didn't say hi, but I'm good. Things are good. I'm glad to be back.
So at the start of each episode of Cult of the Old, we do a one-minute breakdown of the sort of rules and how the game goes. And this time around, I think it's Mr. Nate Owens is going to give us a rundown of Catan.
That's right, I am. Okay, in Catan, the players are all settling the fictional island of Catan. It's fictional because, unlike a real island, it's made up of 19 hexes. And on those hexes, you place your settlements. Your settlements will then generate resources through the roll of a dice. As you generate more resources, you're able to build more settlements, to build roads to connect them, to build cities so that you produce more resources, and then buy little settlement cards that will give you little boosts as well. Settlements and cities are worth victory points, and the first person to get to 10 victory points is the winner of Catan.
Excellent. Nicely done. I make that about 40, 50 seconds by my count.
I have to say, nice job. For our audience, these are deliberately and entirely unscripted.
Let's just get in there and talk about the game.
There's a real baptism of fire being down for the one minute breakdown.
I will say, if there's any game I'm able to talk about for 1 minute because I've internalized every aspect of it, it's this one. So this was the easy one.
A little history of the game before we get into the more nitty-gritty of our discussion. It was released originally in 1995. The designer, as we mentioned, was Klaus Teuber. Its original publisher was Cosmos, so it's had many, many publishers over the years as it's gone out across the world. Now, I tried to find the original artist for the very, very first edition of Catan, but I couldn't quite pin down who that was. The version I knew was the Stephen Graham Walsh version, which is the third edition Mayfair, as I understand it. But there are many artists. We'll link to the BGG page for Catan, and you can have a look at all the artists there for the various versions of it. It won the Spiel des Jahres in 1995. Now, Teuber had won in previous years. He'd won three previous times, in 1988 with Barbarossa, in 1990 with Hoity Toity, the German name I found unpronounceable, and Drunter and Druber in 1991. The game entered the Origins Hall of Fame in 2001, and Teuber himself entered that Hall of Fame in 2004. Now, Catan has been around for quite some time and has many, many versions and expansions. The major big ones were Seafarers in 1997, Cities and Nights in 1999, and it also had a sci-fi edition released in 1999, which was re-implemented as Catan Starfarers in 2019. Barbarians and Traders is the other big expansion you can still find for the modern edition of the game. That was released in English in 2008, with elements of it being available from about 2004 to 2007. There's loads of other expansions for it, loads of little scenarios for it. There was a World Cup one released recently for the Football World Cup, for instance. There's lots of little extra expansions for it that you can find all over the place. Catan was so successful that Toyber was able to incorporate Catan GmbH, that's a German limited liability company, in 2002, and Toyber became a full-time game designer in 1998 due to the game. So, gents, how did we first come across Settlers of Catan, or Catan as it's now actually officially known?
I actually don't remember. which is a testament to kind of both how old this game is and how far it's seeped into the collective gaming consciousness. I was aware of Catan because I essentially played in adjacent hobbies before I became a board gamer. I was more heavily into role-playing games and miniature war games. And you couldn't, you know, pick up the press. We actually had paper press in those days. You remember actual magazines to read through. You remember those?
I remember seeing a review for Settlers of Catan in Arcane, if you remember that one.
I do. Exactly. So yeah. This is the point. You couldn't read those magazines without coming across mention of adverts for and so on of Settlers of Catan. But I did not play it straight away. I mean, I played board games, but they were not hobby board games in the way we now understand them. I played, you know, Avalon Hill, spin-offs, Games Workshop stuff. But when I... It was a deliberate decision. I purposefully made a hard switch away from those into board games for reasons that are beyond the scope of this cast. And I think it was the second game I picked up after Carcassonne, which would have put it in the very early 2000s when I did so. And I had didn't play it that much then. I must admit, I loved it. But at that point in my life, I found it difficult to play 3 to 4 player range. Essentially, most of my gaming time was either 2 player or more than 4. So I didn't get to play as much as I want, and that may explain why I've had such a good time rediscovering it.
I mean, yeah, for me, it was a university game. When I first came to university, I had some background in sort of board games. I had some board game knowledge from, I used to visit Ravensburger, the actual town, as a kid, because my parents had pen pals there, and would pick up sort of German games like Sagaland and things like that. So I had some sort of board game background and a little bit of RPG. I was just starting to get into RPGs when I moved to university, but I didn't really know them much. But Catan was one of the first games I picked up from a local game shop called Black Lion Games. And yeah, it was fantastic. I really, really loved it. I played the thing to absolute death. Whenever we could get together with friends, Settlers of Catan would come out playing on like tiny tables or like student hall floors, etc. My copy, which I eventually got rid of, and we'll come to that eventually, but was just like, it was well used, well loved, that copy of Settlers of Catan. Yeah, it's just a really easy to teach, fun to play game, and by the standards of the time, or the standards I knew at the time, it was pretty good production standard. So yeah, it was just something that just came out all the time. For yourself, Nate?
I also discovered it in university, as my last year in university, and I think I was introduced to it by someone like in the summer, like during the holiday or something. And what I tell people now is that once I discovered it, that I basically minored in the game during my senior year. We were playing every weekend, and what we actually did, our university was not in a big town, and so we went to the only game store in town that mostly sold video games but also sold Settlers of Catan, and me and like 2 or 3 other people went in together to buy a copy, because it was like $40 at the time, which isn't a ton of money, but it is when you're a broke university student. And yep, we each coughed up like $15 or something to buy that and the 5 and 6 player expansion, and we played it to death. And in fact, I'll come back to why this is interesting to me, but the guy who taught it to us, I didn't mention this in my one minute rundown of the game, but a huge part of Catan is that you trade resources with each other, and that's how you get the stuff you need when you can't produce it on the board. And the guy who taught it to us taught us that the trading happened just any old time. You could just shout out and trade and just kind of in real time as it went on, which the rules say you're supposed to, like, on your turn you can trade, and yeah. only with the guy whose turn it is. And it made the game, it was the most chaotic, insane thing. And I played it that way for about 6 to 8 months before reading the rules myself and realizing that I've been playing it wrong. And so that's one of the things I remember about that game, is it was taught to me incorrectly and I didn't even notice. I loved it so much still at that early stage. So yeah, I played it a ton. I actually bought I had that third edition copy that you mentioned earlier, and I sold it to buy the fourth edition when that came out in 07, 08. And I did it so that I could have the expansions, Seafarers and Cities and Knights, because I like both of them a lot. And so, yeah, this has been still a game I really love. I played it on my iPad just before coming in to record, actually. So still play it a lot, still love it.
Yeah, we played a little refresher game to just get it in our heads just before we recorded today, which was actually really nice to revisit, but we'll come back to that.
Well, I'd like just revisit it now, because I think you should spend the rest of the episode referring to me as Lord of Catan.
Yes, Lord of Catan.
Thank you. Sire is also appropriate.
Give me your proper title.
I didn't vote for you.
Sire is also fine, isn't it?
Sire is a fair. I feel I ought to mention that I also went to university, but I obviously went to a lower class university where people play Risk instead.
Well, I went to a lower class university, and that it was an American one. So,
you know. Yeah, at least you get to do minors. I'm jealous.
Yeah, yeah.
We don't get that.
No, we don't. So we think of Catan as sort of the progenitor of the modern hobby, but what games do you think influenced Klaus Teuber in creating Catan? What came before Catan or just before Catan to make it happen?
I actually thought about this a lot, because I like, first of all, I did a fair bit of research, but I could not find games that Teuber himself mentioned as like, yes, this was an influence. Now, I might just not have found it. A lot of stuff gets lost to the annals of the internet. And but one game that came to mind that is not, it's only kind of similar in a kind of a zoomed out way, but that's a game that came out in the early 80s called Borderlands. It was by Eon Productions, actually, who did Cosmic Encounter. And Borderlands was a sort of diplomacy adjacent game, a lot of deal making and that kind of stuff. They were really fond of that sort of thing. But the big thing about it was that you produced resources based on where you were on the board. And you use those resources then to buy more stuff. And that cycle is really similar to Catan in a much longer, more involved, more diplomatic sort of game. But that was one that came to mind for me. But I don't think I'm not aware if it's ever been named as an influence, aside from maybe Teuber just took some inspiration from the broader genre of Civilization style games, which did exist at this point, stuff like Advanced Civ and the original Tresham game and stuff like that.
Yeah, sure.
I think that I was quite frustrated because it was mentioned to us last season, rightly, that we should spend more time rather than just vomiting forth our own opinions into the internet. And I did some, you know, when I was looking into it for the show, I discovered that he actually wrote a book called My Journey to Catan, in which he goes over in detail the design process that he went through, not just for Catan, but a number of other games as well. And frustratingly, it only exists in an $80 limited edition format, and you can't even buy an electronic version. So even if I had time to purchase one from America and have it shipped here, I was not going to drop $80 on it, I'm afraid, no matter what a lovely hardback thing it is in a slipcase. So I would love to know, you know, I couldn't find any quotes from it that gave us any indication. One book I did look in is Everybody Wins by James Wallace, which is a very fun rundown of all the Spiel des Jahres winners, in which he points out that Catan is essentially a reimagining, not a reimagining, but it reuses a number of familiar mechanics in a way that nobody had previously done. And the two things that he particularly points out are Go, and because of the way that you play along the lines, you know, and especially the spaces between the tiles rather than on the tiles themselves, and Magic Realm, which is the first modular hexagonal tile board. And I think it's pretty unlikely he played Magic Realm, to be honest. And in fact, he is on record as having said that he originally made Catan with square tiles and just changed them to hexagonal. Was kind of like a real eureka moment during the design, which I think indicates that it's just a spatial, that innovation was just one of looking at the game and seeing how the spatial possibilities worked out.
You know, now that you mentioned that, another mechanic that it uses is the dice roll, the way you put your stuff on a spot and then you get returns based on dice rolls. It's basically craps, right? I mean, you're placing a long-term bet on the board and having the bet pay off. And in fact, when you get to the end of the game, you'll think about the probability of the rolls, and the probability is set out for you right there. It's very simplified compared to craps, which is kind of an arcane game, but it has like these little dots on all the numbers that says this is how likely on average this number is to be rolled. And so it has you thinking in probabilities. Like, it's very open about that kind of stuff with the production design. And so I think there are not just craps, but a lot of dice games, because I think at its heart, that's kind of what Catan is. It's a dice game and it's a trading game together.
Yeah, that seems entirely fair. I mean, I didn't really know many board games before I came to Catan. I mean, like I had some experience, like I said, some of the Ravensburger stuff and that kind of thing, but I can't really speak to the influences on the game itself. There is a quote from Teuber about sort of the story of the Vikings inspiring him. He says, "Yes, the story of the Vikings inspired me. I imagine how they reached Iceland. They need wood, they need houses, they need other things." From the only place I found that was an interview with the New Yorker in, I think, early 2000s. But yeah, I don't know much about the sort of what led into it. It seemed like a game that, yeah, like maybe came out of that sort of German tradition of slightly less confrontational games as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's very much in the vein of what was already happening in German games at the time, which is a lot of interaction that's not necessarily nasty interaction. Now, it can be in Catan, but even then, it's not. It's not really like backstabbing after 5 hours of diplomacy nasty, you know, and. Hmm. And that's it is very interactive. You're always playing with the other players. And in fact, I think we made this observation when we were playing on Board Game Arena that the game, there's a lot of electronic implementations. I play on Catan Universe on my iPad, and it's great and I enjoy it. But more than any game, I think it is invariably better in person. Because you just need that free flow of information, trades always kind of going back and forth, and the slight grudges that build over the course of a game. You need that kind of stuff just to be kind of flying freely, and just playing electronically just really hampers that. And so that's very German in its design. Like that's especially that early 90s German games, stuff like Hoity Toity or Adel Verpflichtet, which is a great game. I know, yes, I know. But that's a very interactive game. It's got a lot of double guessing. It's kind of random. It looks like this sort of game. Like you can see they're made from the same mind. They feel kind of a piece that way. And so, I think its biggest influences was probably just a lot of trends that were already kind of percolating in German design at the time.
What we'd like to do next in the cast is sort of chat a wee bit about the sort of impact of Catan at the time when it first came out. So what do you think, gents, when Catan first hit the scene, what was the impact for the hobby at the time?
I actually think it was fairly negligible, which seems like heresy to say now in 2023, but I think it's true. It isn't something that just suddenly landed and took the whole world by storm like arguably Dominion did, right? So Dominion, my God, this is revolutionary. Everyone's playing it for 6 months until they found out what a tiresome shell of a game it actually is.
Tune in for our episode of really Dominion.
Yeah. Our episode of Dominion is just Matt going for 5 minutes and then that's it.
You're going to find out how true that is when we actually do it at some point. Anyway, but it didn't just suddenly take the whole world by storm. It was a relatively slow spread. You've got to remember, as we said, this is paper magazine time. The internet was in its infancy. There was no social media to speak of, and its influence spread slowly. It was a word of mouth thing. People like Ian, like Late, like me, picking it up. In a time when nothing like this really existed and going, my God, this is mind blowing. And that just that enthusiasm percolating slowly through the hobby. So to say that its impact at the time was not huge, I think it does sound like it does a disservice to the absolute juggernaut this deservedly became. But I still think it's true.
Yeah, I think it's probably better to say that it was a big hit in Germany, obviously. It won the Spiel des Jahres. And so, you know, I mean, I think in that sense, it was very successful. It had a lot of follow-up releases and stuff like that. But Matt's exactly right that this was pre-internet. And this is more importantly than pre-internet was that this was pre-Board Game Geek. And so something like Dominion, let's use that as an example. Hey, Dominion was followed up with months of hype. Hey, this game is coming out at Essen. This is happening. This is happening. And then when the game comes out, it's like kaboom. It's this big release. It lands. Everyone's like, losing their minds over it. You just didn't have that at all in the pre. And the only exception might be the original release of Magic the Gathering, which all kind of happened at a weekend at Gen Con. You know, I was actually reading an article on that this weekend that the demand was created at Gen Con when the game was announced and people kept on buying all the releases and they shot through like a year and a half of stock in like one weekend. That is almost never happened with games at this time. I think the big thing that happened is that this was probably one of the few games that saw extensive release in the US in an English form from Germany. And I think that's what's really significant about it. There had been some attempts before this. The big one was Hoity Toity, which was not called that. It was called, I think, By Fair Means or Foul or By Hook. It was something like that. It had another name besides its very weird German name. But Avalon Hill did try to print that. And it was really limited success because that's a weird game to start with. And but Catan has a lot of things that I think makes sense to, you know, we're all here playing as people who played a lot of Risk. We played games that had a lot of diplomacy and deal making. We played a lot of Monopoly and stuff like that. The bones of what are here in Catan make a lot of sense as soon as you play them. You understand this idea of building up a structure. You understand this idea of trading because everything in Monopoly is fungible, right? And Risk, you're always making deals with everyone in Risk. And so there's these familiar elements to Catan, but it's like, oh, I'd never seen it put together like this, and it really needed an English release for that to happen because I wasn't going to import a game in early 2000s, which was when I played it. You didn't know to do that. You needed an English release, and I think Mayfair deserves a huge amount of credit for giving this game legs in the English speaking world. Who published it in the UK? Was it published by Mayfair in the UK?
I believe it was Mayfair.
The edition I had in the UK, as I understand it, was the Mayfair third.
Okay.
When I was doing research for the show, I realized that was the edition I had. So yeah, it would have been Mayfair through, it would have been Estivium, I think, at the time, where the distributors, who are now owned by Asmodee. But I think Estivium at the time were the distributors. Yeah, who isn't? Yeah, basically. I mean, I came to Catan a little, I think a little later than Nate, maybe a little earlier than Matt, because like I say, I picked up at university, sort of like late 90s, early 2000s. But it was kind of the thing that was played at a lot of clubs I went to. I remember going down to when Gen Con still existed in the UK. I went down to Gen Con in the UK in, I want to say Manchester, but I might be wrong. It's fuzzy memory. But yeah, there was definitely Catan being played all over the place there as well. And it just felt like when that game came out, there were more people starting to like make and design games and like that being talked about more, like people seeing that game as an influence, and like as I said earlier, it's just such an easy game to teach and play that people just break it out and play it for an hour and then put it away again, and that was just the thing. I think it was also availability as well. It felt like it wasn't hobby board game stores, but it had a slightly wider release. I don't know how they managed that, but I just saw it. So you saw it in the occasional bookshop, that kind of thing. I mean, you see it everywhere now. It's like in supermarkets and everything. But like there was like the occasional bookshop would be carrying copies, that kind of thing as well. So that it was quite available. It was easy to get. Yeah.
You know, that actually might have been part of the reason that Mayfair thought they could release it, because it's not a very it's a pretty Spartan production, really.
Yeah.
You need 19 land hexes and either a frame around the hexes if you're playing certain versions, or more ocean hexes around, and you need a few wooden pieces for each person and a really pretty slim deck of cards. And the resource cards, I guess, but it's not this really, it doesn't require a lot of plastic. It doesn't require a lot of production. And so that makes it a tempting proposition for a company to release for a small press company like Mayfair was at the time.
And at the time, like certainly the card quality in Catan, if I think about it now compared to like modern card quality, was kind of rubbish. Yeah. But it was good enough for that production at that time. And so like you say, it's not like a crazily expensive thing to produce. Well, I remember reading somewhere when I was looking up Catan info for the cast that it was like a lot of it was produced in America, Europe as well. Various bits and pieces sourced in different places and then sort of put together for the actual production itself.
My Catan box is unlined, which is something you never see in nowadays. just raw cardboard on the inside, and I'm pretty sure the cards actually came in a sprue. I think they're actually in cardboard. I could be wrong about that, but rather than being anything you can shuffle,
mine came in a box, like the kind of box that would be like its own SKU at a retailer. That box was inside the big game box, and so it had like, oh, here's the cards for Settlers of Catan. And that's what I remember about it. They had like, so I have these little internal little stack of little card boxes inside my box.
Yeah, I don't recall, but I'm pretty sure my edition had like cards that had already been like, you know, punched out and put together as a deck, and were probably like wrapped in some way or form inside the box.
I could be wrong about that sprue thing. As I said, I can't even remember where I bought it the first time I played it. So all I know for certain is the box is unlined, because I looked into it recently and I was struck by the rough feel of the cardboard against my fingers.
Well, let's move on from the sort of history part of this cast, talking about when the game came out and what its impact was, and move on to talking about our own critical impressions of the game. How do you still like play this game, guys? How do you still see it in a sort of modern context?
I still love it. I really enjoy it. And in fact, I don't know if we're going to talk about this, but Catan is... You can't call a game as successful as Catan actually underrated, but I think among hobbyists it kind of is.
Yeah,
I think hobbyists it's sort of fashionable to act like it's a bad game, and we all know that now. And now we've moved on to better things. And every time I play it, I'm a little struck by like, man, this is really good because of how stripped down it is. Now it's not. I think what frustrates people about it is it's not like. It does have a couple of sharp edges, and it's got a couple of things to it that you just wouldn't do in a game anymore. Again, when we were playing our game, we noticed that to play Catan, you need to be okay that sometimes you'll have a turn when you can't do anything. So you'll be passing the dice around a few turns until something big happens that shakes up the status quo. And I think that kind of offends people on some level. And you would design games today to not do that. You want a game today, you would make sure it always gives you something interesting to do on every turn. And Catan doesn't do that. It also doesn't smooth out the luck at all. Like, it's like, hey, in our game, I sure would have liked a 5 to be rolled so I could get some brick. And it just wasn't happening. Like, I didn't see a bell curve at the end. But on the Catan Universe app, you can see a bell curve of how the die rolls went. And every now and then it's so gratifying.
A little bit more.
Yeah, it's so gratifying when you get to the end of a game and you're like, I thought that 9 was only rolled once or twice, you know? And I think those are the kind of, like, a game today would try to even that out, either with a deck of cards or something like that. At least that's the perceived wisdom from gamers. But I think why Catan works is because it's so elemental. You can pull at it all over the place and make the game hold up. There's all these variants and every scenarios and everything that exist for it because the game is really durable. And in fact, I think one of the things it does really well is it teaches you a little bit of game design. Because it's a short game, you can change something in the game and watch how it affected the outcome and say, oh, the experience was changed because I did this. And I have nothing to back this up, but I actually wonder how many people kind of got interested in game design by just tinkering under the hood with Catan. Because after he gives you, especially after you get the Seafarers of Catan, you have basically a dev kit. Like, you can build weird shaped islands, then you can build islands that are half brick if you want to. You can make numbers like go really pear shaped and really weird. Like, you can do that kind of stuff and the game will probably hold up. It might be kind of weird, but the structure is going to be pretty sound. And I think that's just, that shows such an amazing sense of design and a really durable design. And I think games that are that durable are the ones that really stand the test. because you can learn it from some guy who taught you how to trade wrong. And the game is now really chaotic and really loud, but it's still really fun and it's still basically Catan. And that's so impressive to me. I every time I play it, I'm just amazed by that.
Do you like the expansions, Nate? Because like I had Seafarers and I just never really warmed to it. I think this sort of, I always thought like the core sort of Settlers experience was so well done. It was so simple and so straightforward that I always felt like Seafarers just added like kind of unnecessary complexity to just what was like, just a nice simple game.
If I have my druthers, I would always rather play with one of the expansions.
Fair enough.
And I say that that's not a slight on the original game, because I do really love the original game. But when I'm playing person, it's usually just the original game, because it can take a little longer, especially with Cities and Knights. And Cities and Knights has more sharp edges.
I've never played with that, so I can't speak to it.
It's great. I really like it. And in fact, when I played it on my app before we recorded. That's what I played with Cities and Knights, and I really like it. But there are ways to be knocked out of the game really early on through some dumb luck, and you can mitigate it some if you know what you're doing, but it doesn't always work, and the game can just take longer. It's probably at least a 2-hour game when you're playing with Cities and Knights. In fact, I love combining Cities and Knights with Seafarers. That's like my favorite Catan experience, is the two of them combined. So, you know, there's a lot of ways to do it, and I think those expansions are really solid. Once you get in the 5 and 6 player expansions, I like the original game with 5 and 6 players. I have it for Seafarers and Cities and Knights. I have the 5 and 6 player boxes for those, but I've never tried it with that. I would with Seafarers, but Cities and Knights with 6 people seems like you're now in risk territory with how long that would take.
Yeah, I had the 5 and 6 player expansion, but that, as we've discussed many times before, my game group is quite big and has been for a very long time. So yeah, I always like pick up those kind of expansions for games. I mean, I think for me, Catan falls under a game that I loved and played to death with and then kind of moved on from it. I mean, it's still a huge influence on me being in the hobby at all, and like certainly getting to the point where I wanted to like write and talk about games. I mean, without this game, I probably wouldn't have met as many folk at university. I certainly wouldn't have become involved in the local hobby as much. I mean, as I said earlier, I bought my copy in Blackline Games, which was sort of like the game shop in Edinburgh at the time. And I met loads of folks that I still know now in the Scottish gaming scene through that. So it was a big sort of entry into the hobby at large. I mean, it is like playing again with you guys. We played it on Board Game Arena, where it's readily available. And as Nate says, it's available in various other digital forums as well. I mean, it does struck me how much I just remembered of it. Just the rules are just sort of kind of just in my brain. I think I looked up one thing at one point because I couldn't remember a placement rule or something, but the rest of it was just still in my head because the rules are just, they're incredibly straightforward and simple and almost intuitive in a way. And they kind of make sense within the fiction of that setting. I really liked remembering how nice the hand management thing is, because when you're playing Settlers, if you roll a 7, the robber moves, and if you have over 7 cards in your hand, is it, you have to like discard down, you have to discard down, which means there's like this sort of built-in sort of risk reward thing of like, how much do I hoard and is that a wise thing to do? There's a really interesting choice there.
It's half your card as well, which is really punishing.
I think really punishing, yeah.
Really nasty when you roll the 7 and you've got more than 7 cards, or somebody rolls.
And especially when people are after your sheep monopoly.
Lord
sheep. Looking at no other players in particular.
Watching me squelching in the mud while you just kept all the sheep for yourself.
With our new sheep compact technology, we can make anything. Compact, compact, compact. But yeah, I've floated this theory before with people. Like, the best family games to me, and the sort of the best like sort of intro games to the hobby, they have a mean streak to them in some way or form. There's a sort of permission to be mean to the other people around the table, but not in a nasty way. And Settlers kind of has that with the robber and the way you can trade. There's a sort of slight built-in slight mean streak to it, which I really, really like. Yeah, it's I mean, like you're saying, it is extremely random. You can find yourself kind of out of the game early. You can find yourself frustrated by the randomness, not only in the dice, but maybe in the deck, if you're going for like cards to try and dig yourself out of a hole through the card deck you can buy cards from. I mean, one thing I was wondering while we while I was researching this, is it used to be called Settlers of Catan. Like, that was the name of the game, and the original name of the game was Die Siedler von Catan, I think is the German title. And I wonder if Settlers was removed from the title to sort of get away from the slight colonization kind of thing to the game. I mean, there's not a strong colonization theme, but it is kind of there, and it's been talked about by various other folk before now. What do you guys think?
I find it quite difficult to comment on that, because it is one thing that's very noticeable about Catan in terms of in that context, is that you are not pushing anyone off the island.
It's empty, effectively.
And
especially in the current edition. In older editions, they had illustrations of like meeting natives on a beach or something like that.
Really? Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah, I remember that.
But they don't have that anymore. That's been removed.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, with that history, then maybe it's a good thing to move away from the settlers label, I guess, if that was in the early editions.
To me, it says, like, I think that the newer editions just made a more intentional thing about going back to the Viking imagery, because the imagery now, you know, like, seafarers has like a long ship on the front. The knights have the kind of, you know, those Nordic helmets with the little piece in front of the nose. And, you know, so they've kind of amped up the Nordic Viking imagery. And I think probably the switch to just Catan was probably just a branding thing. Because that's the most, I mean, 90% of the time, that's what we called it anyway, right? And when
it's
you're
like going for a shop to Warhammer.
You call it Settlers, not Catan.
Oh, okay, well, there you go. But I think I think it's an acknowledgement that they had this whole big product line, you know?
Yeah, Catan is the sort of like core game. And like we have
the name, isn't it? And that's the point. You can't copyright the word Settlers. I think you'd be struggling.
Right. There's a PC game called The Settlers, right?
Yeah.
I wonder if it might even have something to do with that.
We mentioned there were lots of expansions and that kind of thing, and there have been like sort of like Catan Game of Thrones versions and things like that as well.
Yeah. Star Trek Catan.
Star Trek Catan, you know, and it's easier to just have that one word rather than the whole title to like have that sort of franchise element to it, I guess. Yeah, I think ultimately Settlers is a game that has like a permanent place in my heart, like for all my board game history, just not in my collection anymore. I moved it on quite some time ago, sadly.
I think it really struck me when we were playing Catan that everything in the game is about anticipation. Mm-hmm. Even when you're waiting to see what's going to come out of the dice roll, you're waiting to see what people are going to trade with you, you're waiting to see what you're going to be able to build, what you're going to be able to do on that turn. And that wait is really angsty. There's a real legend. Oh, come on. I want to see. And that's a big part of why the game works, I think, and why the game is appealing. Maybe just for me, I don't know. But it's I really like that. Even we played an async game over the space of about 24 hours. And when people weren't playing, I was like just checking. Is it my turn yet? I want to see what resources I've got and stuff like that. And so I think that's a big part of what makes it fun. For me, the biggest problem with Catan isn't kind of like the randomness. You know, I like some randomness in games or anything like that. It is that you can tell often fairly early on how it's going to spin out. So you can be like a third of the way through the game and it's like, no, I'm stuffed now. I can't possibly get the resources that I need. I'm too far behind, bar a miracle. Because the thing about the bell curve with the dice is that it's fairly reliable. I know you might not get quite so many nines, you might not get quite so many sixes as you were expecting or whatever, but the idea of compare it with something like, I know we keep doing it, but something like Risk, where you can have some heroic defense of Irkutsk, where your last two troops hold off against the invading hordes from North America, you know, that can happen. You can see off 10, 12 of those pieces and everyone's cheering on every dice. It's not going to happen in Catan. If you don't get a bit of an early break, or you've made a slightly suboptimal choice in putting down your initial settlements, you're a bit stuffed. And likewise, by the mid game, you can often tell who's going to go home to take it, you know, to win it. And neither of those things are good. And we're talking about how short and simple it is. Well, it's not that short. It's a 90-minute game, really. I mean, you know, by modern standards, compared to like a hand of cards, that's not that short. And to have played half an hour of a 90-minute game and know you've got an hour left to go and know that bar some statistical miracle you've got no hope of making it is you know, a bit depressing. The anticipation, you've got the anxious, you've got, oh, I'm not going to get my turn, but it's just not quite the same. And I do think that's a problem, and that's a shame. The angstiness is added by the robber. You know, we talked about that. The am I going to get enough resources to stockpile? Because early on, before you get harbor, you've got to stockpile resources. To make that 4-point trade, you've got to stockpile resources to get a 4-point maritime trade. And to do that, you've got to risk the robber stealing it all from you. That's all very exciting. And I do love, as I mentioned earlier, I do love the Lord of Catan rule. I think that's fantastic. It should be enforced strongly. With every time you play. Yes, thank you very much. No, not just because I won. I do love it. I do think it's great. When we talked about Citadels, we talked about it then.
There's
the throne room one in there.
Just a little bit of flavor to it.
I love that, those little flavor rules. But, well, there's a lot of things I want to say, actually, because I'm going last, I suppose. One of the things I did between these seasons is I played a lot of Spiel des Jahres winners deliberately because I wanted to play all the ones I hadn't played. So I've been playing a lot of older games recently. And I was surprised, given that they're all Spiel des Jahres winners, how mediocre a lot of them were, even poor in some cases. And given its age, given the year of which it's from, Catan still holds up really well. No, it really was a long way in advance of other titles of its era. However, you know, I stay on that problem about you knowing where the game's going to go well before it's finished, for good or for bad. But it's still so much better and so much more interesting and fun to play than many of its peers. Expansions. Now, this is really interesting. What you guys said, but especially what you said, Nate, about being a design kit, because. I like playing with Seafarers. I think Seafarers sorts out... There are known issues with the original design, like sheep. You know, we all know, or experienced players will know, sheep aren't as valuable as the other resources in the initial game. Seafarers, you know, gives you a reason for that. Seafarers, another problem with the original, you know, because it allows you to get off the main body of land and make different maps, it makes it harder for people to get boxed into corners. So it's harder to get that sense of you can still tell when people are going to win early, but it's easier to get out. You've got a bit more hope early on if things aren't going your way that you can break out and get somewhere else that you need to be. I love Seafarers. It doesn't really add any time to the game. I think it's great, and I really like playing with it. I always recommend to play with it. I don't like Citizen Knights because I think it makes the game into something it's not. It's kind of like you said about it becoming risk-like. Not only does it become risk-like, but it becomes longer, it becomes more complicated, and kind of that's part of the reason we play Catan, right? Because we've been talking about how relatively short and straightforward it is, how intuitive it is to teach, which it is, you know? And Cities and Knights takes that away. And so I have played it. It's kind of okay. It's fun enough, but I'm not a big fan of it personally. One other I did want to mention is Helpers, because I think it's one of the most popular ones. The Helpers is just like, it's got like a role selection mechanism it adds to the game whereby, you know, you've got people you can say this turn I'm going to use, I can't remember what they are now, but the shipwright, the stock taker, whatever it is, you know, and they give you a little bonus for that round. And it's nice and simple again, but gives you more strategic options to play with, and it's good fun. I'd recommend that. But I think both of those things feed back into what you were saying, Nate, about it being like a design kit, because the fact there are so many expansions indicates, I know it's kind of a tautology, but it indicates how expandable the game is. Without many of which don't add like a lot of complexity to rules. Now, you contrast that with a lot of modern games, which are really tightly locked together designs. And when you get expansions, you get more cards for all the decks, or maybe another board that you put on, and almost certainly a whole raft of rules. They are not expandable, flexible, malleable like Catan is. I think that's really indicative of the fact that for all the impact that Catan had on this hobby, which is enormous, and we're going to talk about that in a minute, but we have now, 30 years later, nearly moved away from those lessons. All right. So I pulled out a couple of quotes from Klaus, that I'm not going to pronounce it. I'm not going to attempt to pronounce his surname because I'll make a fool of myself. And you know, quote that he said about the game or game design, and the two of them, and they both really speak to this. And the first one is, I don't like games where you have to think too much, where luck plays no part and the better player always wins. Chance makes things more exciting. If I know exactly what is going to happen tomorrow, things get boring. It's the same in a game. The second quote is, I have been an avid reader since my youth because I also like to play tabletop games. I soon felt the desire to make the story narrated in a book or an aspect of that story come alive in a game. And Catan has both these things, right? You know, you are growing your little corner of an empire. There is conflict going on. In the game that we played, you know, we were doing it async, but I thought it was such a shame. Ian and I had a real back and forth with the robber. He kept rolling sevens and sticking on my hexes. I had a handful of luckily for me, and kept on sticking it right back at him. And when we did that, I thought how much fun that would have been, you know, that dynamic would have been if we'd been playing it face-to-face. So there's your narrative, all right? And we've already talked about the chance elements. But now we have created games with this desire for balance, with this desire for sort of like, you know, the focus totally on strategic competition, you know, always reward the better player. We've almost forgotten, I think, some of those really key lessons that Klaus tried to teach us with Catan. We've moved away from that stuff, and I think that's a shame.
Well said.
Matt, I want to push back on something you said. I think the game is not... I think there's a lot of games... If games that involve initial placement will often have issues of... There's better placement and there's worse placement. And especially with Catan, where the setup is so variable, you can end up in situations where you need to kind of learn how to read the board and say, well, first of all, there's always fewer brick and or tiles. There's only three of those. There's four of the other resources. And so if you know that, then you're kind of watching, well, what are the, you know, what are the numbers on there? And you learn to check that kind of stuff out. But I tell you, there's so many games of this I've played that the statistic, you said like a statistically improbable thing has to happen. Catan is great because the statistically improbable thing does tend to happen. And when you don't think so. See, because when I talk to people.
I need to clarify this because we're discussing it. It's not that it doesn't happen. It's that because it's the bell curve of dice, it is rarely game changing. You're not going to get a run of things that you can at least
you can though it does happen I well and
less likely
yeah it, it is well it is less is likely
significant within a single game. It might be significant over many games, that sort of bell curve of probabilities of dice.
Curve becomes more of a bell curve the more die rolls you have, and it's been commented on by a lot of people that Catan probably doesn't have enough die rolls in a game to have a really strong bell curve all the time, because you will get aberrations where like, wow, four never got rolled this game or something like that. And when that happens, it's because you didn't have a big enough sample size. So to me, that doesn't remove the tension of the game, because what you were talking about, that anxiety, that feeling of like, if this happens, I'm good. But if this happens, I'm bad. That kind of, to me, that is not diminished by playing from a disadvantaged spot early in the game. I still find, because it can still happen, and it's unlikely, but it's not that unlikely, you know. 12, 3, 2, those will be rolled most games, and 3 will be rolled quite a bit. And, you know, those kind of things still happen. And so to me, that doesn't lessen the anxiety of the game. But, you know, as with all things, your mileage may vary.
One other thing I wanted to talk about before we move on, you guys may have other things you wanted to chip in with as well, is the trading aspect, because I think that's actually done down a lot. People look at this and they, after the first couple of games, they tend to think, oh, trading's worthless, right? Because either you're going to, there's an advantageous trade that you can make, one for one or two for one or whatever it is, or you're going to say, there's no way I'm giving you that thing because it'll give you an advantage. So no trading's going to go on. And then you start to get harbors, and then the people don't trade with each other. They just trade for two for one with the bank. And I just don't find that's particularly true. I think making those calls is part and parcel of the game. I can think of a number of it. It happened in our game where Ian wanted... No, I needed to get rid of some stuff. That was it. And because I had too many, I was worried about the robber. And I made a two-for-one trade for something, or I offered a two-for-one trade for something that Ian wanted. And then I suddenly said, no, actually, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to take the risk. because I don't want him, you know, that's going to hand him too much of an advantage. And there's another situation where you can make a trade and you think, actually, I'm could build something with that, so I'll let them have it. I'll let them have the advantage. I think I did that with you, Nate, giving you some wins or something.
Yeah.
Remember. So I think the trading works pretty well. I mean, it's not brilliant trading, but one of the interesting things about this is that about trading generally is that it made me think about this. There are very few games that do good trading. And games where you can do good trading, other aspects of the game are often lacking. I played a game which I have now forgotten the name of. Trading on the Tigris. Trading on the Tigris, is that it? I think it might be. And the trading, I'm going to look it up while we talk, but the trading aspect of it was really, really well done. Trade on the Tigris, I think that was it.
Trade on the Tigris,
yeah. The trading aspect of it was really, really well done. And it really, there was like an active market and things went up and down in value. And depending on what people had in trade and what they had in their hands and things like that, there was also a non-mechanical kind of social dynamic aspect of the trading as well. It was really, really well done. But it went on too long. It got too complicated and people ended up with like handfuls of, like, what is this worth? Oh God, I can't be bothered to find this, that. Oh God, you know, the dynamism became too much essentially and nobody could tell what anything was worth anymore and it descended into a degree of chaos. And so the fact that Settlers does it so well actually I think is a boon. I think it's something we shouldn't chunks out of it for. I think trading is hard to do in games properly, and I think trading is actually really fun in Catan and not something we should complain about.
Yeah, the value of each resource is fairly apparent, like, you know, like, and the value changes as well over the course of the game because different resources are, they're more like brick and wood are more important at the start, whereas like ore and grain are more important later when you're wanting cities. So
And it changes based on who you are as well.
Yeah.
Because I mean you can afford to maybe not put something on wheat early in the game because someone might get a bunch of it and might not need it then and they'll trade it to you. And you know, you can kind of float that stuff a little bit. I tell you, I've seen, you know, trading in any game, like all interaction, it's as much, you can be as creative as you want to be with it. It's like, I've heard stories, someone on back in Fortress Ameritrash, I can't remember exactly who it was, but someone mentioned that they played a game of Catan where there was a trade that involved a bowl of cereal. And then there was a really long argument about whether or not the bowl of cereal included milk. And those are the kind of things that, like, you know, certain groups are going to do that naturally. I'm not that kind of person. But also, like, I think it's important to remember Catan was designed as a family game. It's not designed at, like, the competitive, you know, World Board Gaming Championship kind of level. And I think which is not an excuse, but I think when people play at that level a lot, there's this kind of tendency to think, well, games that aren't designed to that caliber don't have value. And I think Catan to me just flies in the face of that so much because it, you know, it's one of those things where gamers can't tell how good a game is sometimes because they're just so stuck on the hobby and stuck with a certain kind of mindset. Now I get why people would be tired of a game. I mean, shoot, there's a lot of games I used to really love that I'd sold off and I'm not into anymore. And I get that. But to say it like, you know, the way people talk about it is like, oh, it was never good. Like, why did we think about it? You know, I saw one article while I was looking through this, and I think it was published in The Atlantic, but I don't remember. But it was talking about how Catan ended up being this iconic game because we could all agree on it. And it was like, you know, I didn't read the whole thing, but it was like the gaming equivalent of a McDonald's, right? The least offensive game, and we could all agree on it. And to me, that's such weapons grade crap. You know, it's like, to me, that's just someone who just has an axe to grind about this particular game. And a lot of people do if you go in some places. And it's a shame, but I think that the people who play it with their families, who don't own anything else, they're crying all the way to the bank. They're having a lot of fun at the game table. And it creates a lot of hobbyists, as Ian and I for sure say that. And Matt was already in the hobby, but it changed his view of the hobby. And so, you know, it was a first step for so many of us.
I think that's a good moment to segue into our next section, which is where we talk about how the game has influenced the sort of modern era, the current era of board games. So we've spoken a lot about sort of influence Catan had at the time and our own critical impressions now. Does it still hold influence over the modern board game scene?
Oh, we're doing a podcast about it now. I mean, it depends. It depends.
Yeah, but we're weirdos.
I don't think that you can see the influence of Catan directly in many games anymore. I'm not sure that you can see it directly in that many games that came out directly afterwards. I don't know. It is so big, Catan, that it's kind of hard to see. It's the wood for the trees almost. But at the same time, it is that big. Yes, the wood for the sheep. At the same time, it is a game that changed the way that everybody thought about games, because before Catan, everything was war games, basically, in America and Britain, or war game adjacent. They weren't all war games, but you could see the influence of war games in almost all of sort of like, you know, the dungeon crawling games, the adventure games, the things that we had. And if it wasn't that, it was Ludo, you know, and family card games. And this introduced a whole new paradigm to the English speaking word, which already existed in Germany, right? So Settlers is not the first game in that ilk. And I think maybe, especially for newer players, they may not necessarily understand that. Hoity Toity almost did it. We've talked briefly about the fact that it didn't, partly because I think it is an overly complex game for what it gives you compared to Catan, especially. There's a lot of fiddliness in Hoity Toity of remembering of
well, what you yeah, think. it's a strange, it doesn't have proper turns. Like that's like if someone's coming to this kind of game to say like, well, whose turn is it? Well, there are no turns in this game. And that's
a hard concept to get.
Yeah, what? Yeah, that doesn't make any sense.
So the point I'm trying to make, I suppose, is that if it wasn't Catan, it would have been something. Something would have opened up the eyes of everybody else as well to this extraordinary new paradigm of games. But it was Catan, and it was Catan for a lot of good reasons, because of that we've already talked about, because it's so accessible, fast, lovely, dynamic blend of different elements together in one. So it's almost so impactful, so influential, that you can't see the individual elements of that anymore. And now, as you said early on, to go back to where we started, Nate, it's fashionable to hate on it. And yet, it is, in a way, in the DNA of almost every modern game that we play.
Yeah, I mean, I think by definition, any game that gets an entire shelf to its own product line at a game store has had an enormous impact on the hobby. I think that's almost, you know, I can't think of an exception to that. Even something like Munchkin, which, you know, I'm not a big fan of, but hey, a lot of people play it. And I think Catan is one of those games that it has really transcended the hobby. Like, we talked about a lot of games last year that were last season that were really successful, stuff like Pandemic, stuff like you know, there was stuff like that was, yeah, it's crossed over and become something bigger. But I think Catan, the thing about Catan is it doesn't need the hobbyist to say it's good anymore. You know, it doesn't need us because it's already gone on to that stage. It's probably never going to be as big as Monopoly, but you're never going to find something that, you know, I there's very few board games that could ever break into that. But it's come as close as anything has in board games in the last 30, 40 years. Like, really, like, I'm trying to think of another board game that's actually passed it up and been more successful since that time. And I can't think of it. The gaming's hits since then have been Magic the Gathering and Catan. And that's really amazing. I do think it's fair to say there aren't a lot of direct, it doesn't have a lot of descendants directly. Yeah. And part of that is because the game is, you know, there's this thing in role-playing, people complain about 5th edition of Dungeons & Dragons that everyone keeps playing it all the time because they'll keep trying to hack whatever rule set. Oh, I want to play a cyberpunk game. We'll just play it in 5e. And that drives hobbyists crazy, but Catan has that quality. Like, there's almost like it's really, you would have to really kind of look, really break the mold a lot to say, I want a game like Catan that you couldn't just recreate somehow with Catan. And I think that that's, and I say that I'm not a designer myself, so maybe I'm just not thinking creatively enough, but I think a game that's that expansive and is that malleable, it almost defeats its own descendants in that way. I think one underrated aspect it had, I think it kind of put this, for at least for English speakers, put the Spiel des Jahres on the map. I think there's a real, certainly, I mean, I think people started paying attention to it. And within the next 5 years, it was a huge deal that Puerto Rico lost the Spiel des Jahres to Villa Paletti. And that was a kind of a minor hobby scandal because people were thought, well, but it really mattered to people who won the Spiel des Jahres. And I think we can point that, we can start, at least for the English speaking world, we can point to Catan for that. It still had a lot of impact, but I think the impact has been kind of beyond the hobby at this point.
Yeah, I think I agree with both of you. It's like, it's a game that changed the perception of what the hobby could be or what a hobby game could be about. And it's reached such stratospheric levels of sales. Like, I was just having a quick Google as to how much Pandemic has sold. The only thing I could briefly find was from 2021. They said they'd sold over 5 million copies. Now, that's only a couple of years back. The most recent number I have on Catan is 40 million copies in over 40 languages. So that game is global. It's everywhere. That's an absolute, I mean, I don't know what Monopoly sales are, but they're going to be much larger than that. But that's a whole different discussion, indeed. And yeah, I think it introduced the hobby games. Like you say, like you were saying, Matt, like for Catan, a lot of games were like war game or war game adjacent. And I think it introduced the hobby gamer to games that could be gentler, like a different style of game, that sort of German style of game design. I mean, there have been some copycats. I remember there's been some sort of Catan copycats coming out shortly after Catan, but they all sort of just disappeared into the dust. And in term, like, I agree with you that there's not much direct influence on the actual game design from like elements from Catan have like filtered down. I don't think that's the case. But in terms of folk being aware the hobby exists at all, you can't underestimate its influence. It was just absolutely incredible. I mean, it's like you can buy it in like your local Tesco or Sainsbury's supermarkets in the UK.
Yeah.
Like you can buy it in Walmart, you know, year round. It's not just at Christmas when you're looking for toys and games for your kids or anything. It's just there. It's in your local bookshops. It's just everywhere.
We've mentioned several times there about, you know, comparing its sales and influence with that of Monopoly. And I think I just want to go back to that New Yorker article. And this is something that you found, Ian, back in our show notes. Another quote from the designer, which is he said, "I do not see that Catan will kill Monopoly, but I hope that Catan will become a permanent classic game beside Monopoly." And I think what greater tribute, you know, we started this episode saying that we wanted this to be a tribute to him. And what greater tribute to his work can there be than the truth, you know, the fact that that's come true. That is true. It is a permanent classic game beside Monopoly. And well done. And thank you so much, Klaus, for bringing that paradigm to all of us. You know, we probably wouldn't be here doing this today without the work that he did.
Yeah, absolutely. Well said. So let's bring our cast to a close, folks. We'd like to like sum everything up with some conclusions and maybe some recommendations as well. So would you still recommend Catan to a modern audience, chaps? Or would you recommend something else instead? Do you think it's maybe had its time? Would you introduce people to the hobby in a different way?
I like it. I think it's a great game. I'm not sure I would recommend it, I must admit, because of the issues that we've talked about. It runs a little bit long compared with some introductory games now, and it's got that feeling of oh, I'm trapped here, or I'm going to run away with the game. But having said that, although it is exemplary, as we've said, in terms of trading, but having said that, still think everybody should play it just because it is such an important slice of gaming history. You know, it's a bit like saying that you're a music fan and you haven't listened to the Beatles or something. You know, it's such a key part of the modern, the makeup of modern gaming that you need to play it, I think, just for the experience, and don't listen to the naysayers. You'll have a good time.
Yeah, I mean, I've never been one of those people that's like, if you want to be a board game critic, you should play, you must have played blah, 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 or that. But I think there is an exception in Catan because it was so fundamental in creating the modern hobby as we know it. So I think it is one of those games I would say, like, yeah, if you want to get into board game criticism, if you want to sort of think about board games, if you want to think about the modern hobby, yeah, you sort of have to go back to the progenitors of that hobby, and Catan is definitely one of those. So for that sort of person who's interested in the history of the hobby, absolutely, it's a recommend. I think for myself, I don't think I'd introduce the modern hobby to people with it anymore. I think I'd go for other games. I mean, weirdly, I had a comparison with like one of my favorite games, which is basically unavailable, so I wouldn't actually use it as a recommendation. But Lords of Vegas includes dice rolls for production. It involves trading. It involves making deals. I absolutely adore it. We'll probably cover it on a later episode at some point. But yeah, it's a fantastic game, which is unfortunately unavailable.
There's a reprint coming out. There is a reprint coming. I know, because you made me. You forced me at gunpoint to back the Kickstarter with your enthusiasm. Ton of enthusiasm.
Well, there's a Kickstarter.
Matt had no choice.
I'm not sure if that's widely available, but yeah. But yeah, there's a lot of other games out there I think I would probably introduce people to the hobby with. And a lot of times these days, like, I don't like to just have one game to introduce folk to the hobby. I like to tailor it depending on their tastes. So there's so many good games out there now. Like, there's a great pile of fantastic games, or lots of different interesting themes, but all those come back to the fact that the modern hobby exists at all, and that wouldn't exist at all without Catan. So yeah, play it for the history aspect for sure, but there is definitely better out there in terms of actual games these days, I think.
Yeah, I mean, if you are somehow listening to this podcast, you made it an hour in and you have not played this game yet, like, I can't imagine that person is here, but if you are, you really should play it. And you really should play it with other people. You can get an app, and the apps are pretty fun. I like Catan Universe works. It's enjoyable. They're real-time games. Hey, if you do it, hit me up on social media. We'll be friends. I'll play with you. But, you know, you really owe it to yourself to play it with other people. And I actually think where this game works best is with families. With friend groups. I think if you're a hobbyist already and you're already steeped in board game and you haven't played Catan up to this point, it's like you should definitely try it, but measure your expectations. It's a little like when someone says, oh, I've never seen Star Wars before. And I always tell people, like, listen, I give you permission to not like it if you do see it, because if you're the kind of person who loves Star Wars, you would have seen it already. Like, you know, I mean, that's kind of like circular thinking, I know, but I think Catan is kind of like that. Like, if you're into board games, I guarantee you've played it at some point. What I would recommend for hobbyists, all that to say, I would say, like, hey, if you don't play board games at all, this is still one of very few games I would say, hey, you know what? This is a pretty good one. You can find it for not a ridiculous price. It's expensive for as people think about board games, but it's, you know, you can tell them, say, listen, you'll play a bunch. Like, it's really fun. If your family likes games, this is great. Like, it's a really, really good choice for that. Widely available, really expandable if you're into that. And if not, you'll still really enjoy it. If you are a hobbyist and you've kind of, you've either haven't played it in a while, there's a ton of ways to try it that are really interesting. And I think you owe it to yourself to just take a stab at one of those sometime. You might find one you really like, you might not, and you might move on with your life. But I think it's one of those things, it helps us as hobbyists, it keeps us grounded, I think, to come back to Catan every so often. So I would recommend it with those caveats. If you're a family and you just have like one or two other games, hey, it's a great candidate for that. Not the only one, there's a lot of options. It's really good for that. But if you're a hobbyist, there's a lot of interesting ways to play it you probably haven't seen yet. And that's worth revisiting as well.
Fantastic. Well, thanks very much for listening, everyone, and we'll see you next time on Cult of the Old. So say we all.
So say we all.
So say those two.
Thanks very much for listening. Editing for the cast was done by me, Ian McAllister. The music for the cast was provided by my brother-in-law, David Dolliver, with my friend, Alistair McLeod. Our logo was created by Rachel Wines-Thrower. If you like what you've listened to, then the best way to help us out is by telling your friends about us and leave us a review and rating on your podcast host of choice. You can follow the hosts on various social media platforms, and we'll put links to all of those in our show notes. You can come and chat to the team and fellow game enthusiasts in our Discord, and if you'd like to support us financially, you can do so through our Patreon. Links to both of those will be in the show notes as well. If you'd like to contact us about any of the games I've covered on the cast, should cover, or anything else really, you can contact us at cultoftheolduk@gmail.com. Bye for now.